This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello and welcome to the National Museum of Australia. It's lovely to see so many people here today for the 2018 In Conversation with the Australian of the Year, which is a great event that we've had the privilege of working on with the National Australia Day Council for a few years now. I would like to begin today by saying my name's Luke. I'm part of the lifelong learning team here at the National Museum, and it's great to be able to put together so many events for you all. And of course, we should start by doing the acknowledgement of country. So I'd like to start by acknowledging the Ngunnawal, Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, who are the traditional custodians of this land on which we are meeting, and pay respect to their elders, both past and present. And of course, I extend this respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders present here today. So this is actually the fourth in the series that we're here for today. So the previous Australian of the Years In Conversation featured people like Rosie Batty, David Morrison, Alan Mackay-Sim, and of course, today we're joined by the 2018 Australian of the Year, Michelle Simmons. And of course, there's someone sitting on stage with Michelle, and many of you may recognise Dan Boucher, who is, of course, an Australian journalist, and he also features on our screens during the 7 p.m. news bulletin on ABC TV, as well as the breakfast program on ABC Radio Canberra. And, of course, he's been previously a political reporter and the National Indigenous Affairs correspondent for Sky News Australia. So today we've got about 40 minutes of the In Conversation, and we're hoping to allow for about 15 to 20 minutes for your questions. So as the conversation goes on, do start thinking about the questions you'd like to ask. We'll actually run around with some Q&A mics. So when we get to the Q&A section of today, please just hold up your hand and we'll try to get a mic to you as quickly as we possibly can. And at this moment in time, I'll hand over to Dan to introduce Michelle. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Luke. Welcome, everyone, and thanks for joining us here at the National Museum today as part of In Conversation with Great Australians, our Australians of the Year, who have done, well, remarkable things in our community. It's important that it happens, this conversation, at an institution like the museum, which is about telling, in part, our national story, and I echo those sentiments that you've already heard, paying my respects to the traditional owners and the custodians of this land who have been maintaining story and song lines for tens of thousands of years. And we'll be talking more about contemporary issues today, but I think it's always very important to look to the past. Right now, though, I'm sitting alongside, well, an esteemed Australian, our Australian of the Year for 2018, Michelle Simmons, who is well known as a science communicator. She's been dubbed a science evangelist. We'll get to that in a moment, I suspect. But also an expert quantum physicist and who has been leading the charge on some of the big discussions, debates, and also research about the big picture right down to the molecular. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Professor Simmons. Great to have you along today. I first spoke to you immediately after you were announced as the recipient. And for anyone who isn't familiar with that ceremony, it was all bells and whistles. There was a lot happening. And before you came and had a chat with me, you just needed a few minutes to stand by yourself, sitting at the end of the desk while I was interviewing other people, which you just needed some time to reflect. Yeah. 12 months on, give us a sense of what this year's been like.
It's been an amazingly busy year, but I've, you know, had a wonderful time. I've got to travel across Australia, meet people from young school children. I particularly love talking to young school children. They're very curious and open, all the way through to travelling internationally and representing Australia overseas. So it's a very unique insight you get to see into what is Australia, and, you know, it's made me prouder than ever to be Australian.
You spoke 10 months ago about how bizarre it felt to have this honour cast upon your shoulders. Does it feel any different now?
No, it still feels incredibly weird. I think a lot of people think that you get the heads up that it's happening, but you really don't know until that moment. Yeah. And so it's a real shock, first of all, and then you feel that tremendous responsibility. You know, but it's, you know, what a great country to be a representative of. So, you know, it's been great.
Let's talk about your field of expertise. You've made, one of the things that I think I'm quite thrilled about is that you've made quantum physics something that's more accessible. That's not without its challenges, is it?
It's not. It's not. So really, it's you know, it's understanding the way the world works at its very smallest. So the smaller you get, quantum physics starts to dominate. But if we can, you know, it's like seeing a new way of visualizing the world around us. And if we can understand that and actually control it, we can actually hopefully build computers that allow us to do calculations we simply can't do. And so, you know, that concept of how it's technologically very important for Australia to get behind this and understand it, and actually the realisation Australia's at the forefront across the country in this field is, you know, something that's very exciting, and I think, you know, everyone should know.
And to that end, eventually, one of the aims that you have is creating a computer so strong, so powerful, that it can determine answers to problems that may have ordinarily taken thousands of years. How do you begin to grapple with a power that is so strong?
Yeah, look, it's, you know, for us, I guess we've, you know, I've been interested in history of the evolution of classical computing and going, you know, really everyone knows that we use computers every day, has taken them for granted. But if you look at the history of the computer, it started, you know, very simply with one transistor and then the integrated circuit, 10 transistors working together. And, you know, 50 years later, we have that powerful computing that we now take for granted. But everyone can communicate across the world. Things happen real time. But the reality is classical computing only does one thing after another. And so when you write code, it literally follows like an automata, one line of code after another. If you've got a system with lots of variables, complex systems such as the weather, or, you know, trying to predict how to reduce fuel costs for airlines, or how molecules interact with the body, such as drug design, all of that is just too complicated for classical computers. They just can't do it. It takes too long. And so this ability to look at the world in a different way is going to open up a whole new power in computing if we can harness it.
So at the core of this is being able to do, to multitask, essentially.
It really is. So we call it massively parallel computing, but, you know, and even to build the computer, you've got to have experts in the fabrication, the chip design. Then once you get through actually making the chip itself, you've got to test it at very low temperatures with very high frequency currents and voltages measuring across it. So it's right at the forefront of all the measuring capability we have about how to measure an individual electron and an individual atom. And then at the end of that, we want to model it and make sure we understand it mathematically. And then we're right at the forefront of that modelling field. So all of those are pushing the boundaries of where technology currently is.
How far are we from that type of a computer?
So some would argue it exists already. So once you start, you know, that's true. So once you you want to control the quantum world, you want to put information in, create this process called entanglement, where you've accessed that quantum power, and then you want to read the information out. And those processes have been demonstrated already. Indeed, we've demonstrated that in our lab. But you want to get a computer that acts faster than a classical computer for a well-known type of problem. And that's the kind of the challenge that everyone's heading for now. And when that's realised, that will be when quantum computer becomes a practical reality.
And you spoke about the applications that could have for weather, for, say, the price of fuel for airlines. Would it have practical applications for any of us in this room, for our home computers, for the way that we communicate?
Yeah, so in the first instance, probably not. So in the first instance, it's really going to be like almost the first computers with these big mainframes that existed and people would send jobs to.
That were the size of a room.
So they're not quite as big as that now because the chip itself is very small. But they are quite big still. These well, they're called cryostats. They're dilution fridges. They cool the chips to very low temperature in a controlled environment. But ultimately, it's going to be the same thing. People will send particular jobs. So it will be big corporations that have complex calculations will send those to this computer and get the answers back. And eventually, as those computers grow and we understand what they can do, eventually I imagine people will start getting access to them directly.
This is something that you're clearly passionate about. What is it about this arena of the sciences that has so captured your imagination?
It really is the fact that we don't, you know, we know so little about the world. In the quantum world, it's a whole new world that exists around us all the time, and we have little glimpses in it. And so, you know, if we can understand, you know, essentially our bodies are made of atoms. The way we are is made up of signals that we're processing to our brains. And we, you know, we can't model more than 20 atoms with a classical computer. So having a computer that's powerful enough to try and mimic how the body works, how the brain works. Eventually, we'll understand more about who we are and the world around us. So that's what really excites me.
And I wonder, do you ever grapple with that question of just how little we do know?
All the time, even in our field. So one of the things that I find very exciting is, you know, in the digital world, it's ones and zeros. It's literally black and white. And that's the way the digital world works. It's actually very limited. Mm. When you hit the quantum world, you're looking at the colour. You're looking at everything in between. And you realise you're having to think in three dimensions rather than two dimensions. Everything is more complicated mathematically, conceptually, visually. And so, you know, we're kind of sticking our toe in at the moment and realising, oh, my goodness, there's all that out there. You know, can we grapple with it? Can we, if fundamentally we can understand it mathematically, picturally, and be able to and write it down, we'll get a better understanding of the way the world is around us.
And you spoke about one of the joys of being Australian of the Year was being able to speak to so many young Australians.
Absolutely.
Is that what you see the shining or beginning a sparkle in their eye, is that idea of the possibility?
Yeah, absolutely. So the thing I love about young people is that they are inherently curious. They haven't learned to be nervous about what they say or think, so they will just ask questions. And, you know, fundamentally, understanding the world requires that you constantly ask, you constantly doubt, you constantly question. And as we get older, we get more fearful of doing that, whereas young people, they don't care. And so spending time with young people, I encourage everyone to do it, because they always ask things, and no matter how you see the world, it will throw your view a little bit. It will question it, and it make you rethink what you've already, you know, thought you've understood up to that point.
Perhaps without the filters that we put in place upon ourselves.
Unfiltered life. Wouldn't it be great if you could have that the whole time?
It could be quite dangerous to us, particularly in my line of work. I want to take you back to 1992 to start to paint the picture of the evolution of your own career. This was when you did your PhD, and now you're going to have to excuse me if I get some of these more scientific terms incorrect, but it was on the characterization of CDTE, which I think is an acronym based epitaxial solar cell structures fabricated by MOVPE. So what is that?
It's a terrible title for a PhD thesis. That's what it is. Looking back now, I'd never get my students to have titles like that. But no, it was really making a solar cell. It was making a solar cell, and the idea was to try and make a more efficient solar cell than what had existed today. And so it literally was, you know, one of the things that I have a big passion about is creating your own technology, not just using it, not getting online and sitting, you know, endlessly getting information, but actually create things. And so that my PhD was about making a device from scratch, actually growing a crystal, slicing it up, making it into chips, and then growing different epi layers, so small layers of material. And the idea being that each epi layer would capture a certain fraction of the sunlight, because sunlight's got lots of different wavelengths, and to create multiple wavelengths that we can capture, so more efficiency in a solar cell. And it actually worked. So the fascinating thing was, you know, it's a very complex, lots of different techniques that I had to learn, but at the end of the day, we did get a high efficiency cell. The tragedy was it wasn't going to be economically competitive with silicon.
Right. So, and that's the challenge, one of the challenges then, isn't it, of some science, is that an enormous amount of work can go into it, but it will just cost too much to replicate that on a mass scale.
That's right. And so, you know, fundamentally, if you want to build something that's useful to society, you've got to take all of that into account, the economics as well as the fundamental understanding. And, you know, and I guess one of the challenges in science is you have to have that fundamental understanding to know what's going to come out in the future. You can't pick it too early. Because if you pick too early, you might pick the wrong thing and nothing will come. So you've got to have that fundamental base all the time, generating ideas. And then as it grows, seeing, well, this one works, this one might not.
I suspect that that's what kind of set the pathway towards that your focus on fabrication of atomic scale devices in silicon and germanium.
Yes. So now we've moved from those kind of epi layers, where we were literally growing layer by layer. Now we can actually control every dimension with atomic precision. And so we're literally the only group in the world that can put an atom in place and then address signals to that atom and read them out from that atom. And that's very exciting, I've got to tell you.
Well, it's pretty amazing, isn't it, as well?
It's great. And every day we go in the labs, and when you've been working it for a number of years, you might think you get fed up with it, but I absolutely love every device we make, seeing the signals come out, watching it. It's great.
How much trial and error was involved in getting to that point?
Actually, you know, it's interesting. So we set out a plan probably back in 2000, an 8-step plan. This is what we're going to do. Each of those steps had never been done before. And people would say, look, that's terrific, but, you know, you've got to get through all 8 for it to work. You know, good luck to you. Actually, people from overseas would say, good luck, you Aussies, off you go. And so that,
better
you
than us, perhaps.
Yeah. And so that really kind of galvanised me, because there was no reason why each step couldn't work. Mm. You know, so we did a lot of, you know, reading and theoretical understanding. And if we could get there, the benefit would be we'd be able to make devices that just didn't exist and could make a quantum computer. And so as every step was knocked down, it's a fantastic feeling. You know, and when you get to the eight and you finally make the first single atom transistor, that's just an unbelievable feeling.
Yeah.
Nothing beats that, that feeling of something that's taken a long time and there it is.
And does that happen in a lightning bolt moment where you just realise, oh my heavens, we've done it?
No. So it's, you know, it's thorough, systematic, hard graft. There's no way, you can't bypass that. I think this is true of any industry you create. It's genuine hard work and it's ruthlessly systematic. You can't bypass. There's no quick routes to get there. Yeah. And that's one of the things I try and teach young people. If you want to be successful, you've got to realise that you've got to put that time and effort in. Yeah. And, you know, the more you put in, the deeper you understand it, and the more unusual things you'll come up with.
Yeah.
But I said the transistor, it took us, you know, many years to build the eight steps, literally a decade to get to those eight steps. But then even when we made the final transistor, it would have taken about 2 or 3 weeks, and at each step it could have failed. Yeah. So we kind of had got to the point we knew what each step should look like. And then eventually we finally saw the end result. And it looked, you know, at high level, exactly what we were expecting. But then at the detail level, there was all kinds of stuff we were not expecting.
Yeah.
And as a scientist, that's even more exciting, because suddenly there's the things there you're not predicting.
Well, that throws up the additional challenges, doesn't it?
It does. And then it really tests your understanding. Gosh, we thought we understood everything, but here's this. What is it? Yeah. So it took us about another 6 months to a year to publish it, to figure out what all those other features were.
And was that then what led to creating the first, well, being the only group to create an atomically precise device in silica? And why is that so important?
So that atom that we've put in there is a phosphorus atom. It has one extra electron compared to silicon, and we're encoding information on that electron spin. So it's literally that electron spin, that what we call our quantum bit or qubit. And that gives us this, you know, instead of the ones and zeros, it sits in between, and that allows us to access the quantum world.
Mm. And in and of itself, that atom, what does that do? What does that power? How is that used?
Yeah, so it literally is. Whenever you encode any information, you are doing ones and zeros. So a letter A or B will have a whole series of ones and zeros in a string. But you literally only have those two states. In the quantum world, you can look at the states in between. And the advantage of that is when you encode in the quantum world, you're able to do calculations in parallel. So instead of one after the other, it's massively parallel, and that's really the benefit of the quantum world.
Mm. I want to take you back to the travels that you've had around Australia over the last year. You mentioned there in passing about what you've learned about Australia. What's the takeout been for you?
It's a huge number of things. One is, you know, just a fantastic sense of collaborative spirit, very community-minded, highly competitive in certain areas. You know, so obviously we see that in our sporting fields, but actually in the scientific arena, we're incredibly strong. So the research base across Australia is in a great position. And so I've seen all of those things as I've gone around, and the fact that, you know, people like to have a joke. Even in this time of political correctness, Australians don't take themselves too seriously, which I love. But, you know, one of the things I've learned, which I was surprised at, and I've really learned this throughout the year, is that kind of aversion to risk when it comes to creating companies.
Mm.
And so really strong research base, willing to take on the world in research. But when it comes to translating to creating a company, there's suddenly a fear about, you know, Australia doesn't traditionally do this. You know, should the others do it and we get the benefit when they've made it and we just then buy it in afterwards? So that was something I wasn't expecting.
What do you think that's about? Is that culture, or is that intrinsic, or is it tall poppy syndrome?
Oh, it's a mixture of all of those things. I've tried to unpick it, and I guess, you know, it is risk aversion. It's not done, so it's new. But there's also this sense that, you know, maybe we can't do it here. And it's, you know, I don't know why it's there. It's, you know, my biggest thing I've learned this year is there's so many fantastic positives, you know, giving it a go and taking on ambitious projects. I just would love to see Australia push through that and create companies over and over again.
Yeah. And you've done that this year as well, haven't you?
So we're doing that
as well,
that
as being Australian of the Year. You just thought, let's start a company as well.
So that took a long time too. So the creation of a company took us many years. But yeah, we started a company, Silicon Quantum Computing, this year. And that's really trying to build the hardware here in Australia based on all this technology that we've developed.
Yeah, and how's that going?
Oh, it's great. Yeah. It's really good. So it's allowed us to accelerate. I guess that's the other thing is, you know, when you have a company, you've got to give it everything. Mm. The research space is very much collaborative and, you know, keeping up with the rest of the world or leading the rest of the world. In a company, it's full-on devotion to try and create something. It's taking it from fundamental to applied research. It means you've got to talk at a very different level to investors. You're hiring new people who are engineers rather than research scientists. We've actually created an unusual situation. We've got the company sitting next to our Centre of Excellence. It's a unique model in Australia. It hasn't happened anywhere else in the world. And it's trying to play off the benefits of that highly collaborative and highly competitive Australian research base with a company building a prototype.
When you talk about research, there's been a lot of media focus on government spending in the research arena in universities. I wonder if you have a view on the impact that that's having.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, one of the things, again, I see, you know, if we look at that research base, it has come from, you know, the Australian Research Council. It has been, you know, fed well over the last two decades. We wouldn't have so many terrific results internationally if it hadn't been supported. And there's a lot of fundamental schemes, such as the Research Fellowship Scheme from the Australian Research Council, or a Centre of Excellence scheme where lots of people are collaborating at a very high level in a way that's unique internationally. And it's, again, it's something not many people are aware of. But when I go overseas, a lot of people say, oh, you know, you've got a great system, Australia. You get these fellowships that give you leadership at a young age. You've got centres of excellence that allowed you to build scale and capacity. And so we are really highly regarded overseas and not so well known here. But, you know, that said, you can always have more funding for research.
Absolutely. And I wonder if there's a risk if the model or the dynamic of funding might change if, say, national interest at the behest of politicians becomes paramount to the way money is spent or where it's spent.
You say, I think the interesting thing for me is national interest and national benefits have always been there. So in every research grant, there's always a session at the end.
Is the challenge the interpretation then of it, or if it becomes a political tool rather than part of a broader discussion?
Yeah, I haven't seen it become a political tool. And so my sense of it, you know, essentially we are funded by taxpayers to do research. We are accountable to them to do the right thing with the research dollars. And wherever we can, we should be trying to create economic benefit if we're able to. So obviously some fields are so fundamental, it's not easy to do that. Other fields are at the forefront. And so I do think it's always important to have that context of we're getting funding, we've got to do the right thing, we have to look at how internationally leading we are in this field, if we can compete in that space, and what benefit can we bring back to Australia. I think every researcher should have that forefront.
One of the big challenges that Australia is grappling with is that around gender in, well, across the board, but in the sciences, in young people, young women moving into STEM. This is one of the challenges that you've spoken about quite a bit through this year, but over the many years of your career. Are we getting any better?
I think we are. I think across the world, people have recognised that there's, you know, a disparity there and have been trying to figure out why it's there and what to do about it. Other countries have been probably ahead of Australia in that, but in the last few years, I've seen lots of programs come up in Australia, whether it's, you know, the female superstars of STEM with Science Technology Australia, or it's research fellowships targeted at females. So there's lots of things, especially young girls now. The opportunities are fantastic. So the ability to go and do work experience and get funded for that, if they're interested, is definitely growing. But, you know, one of the things I've really looked at is what point does it drop off? And it's really the age of 14 to 16 that young girls start to move away from those kind of, you know, engineering, maths, computer science subjects and physics. And really at that point, you know, if you talk to them and figure out why, you know, why you're not doing it, a lot of it's careers. So they're looking at, you know, what is my career going to be if I stay in this subject? And it's not obvious, You can't plot. If I'm a physicist, where am I going to end up? Whereas if you're, you know, if you're a medic, you know, you're going to have a career in medicine or a lawyer. And so, you know, over the last year, what I've been trying to say to them is, you know, don't worry about where you're going to end up. Jobs are changing so quickly now that you should be focusing on what you love and building skills around what you love. And if you build the skills around the things you like, whether it's, you know, design, whether it's maths, statistics, computer coding, you know, dance, music, whatever it is, build the skills around what you love, and the job opportunities will be in that space. You know, so get your options and open them up as much as you can by picking up skills, and don't worry about where you see yourself in the long run.
It strikes me as though it was today, 10 months ago, that we last spoke, and one of the comments that you made, particularly to young women, is don't be defined by the expectations of others.
Absolutely.
What were you meaning by that, and has that changed at all?
Yeah, so I guess this goes back to a story of playing chess with my father, and You know, he didn't expect me to know how to play when I first played him, and I ended up beating him on the first game. And he...
How'd that go down?
Not too well, I'll be honest with you. He played me 10 games and thrashed me in a row every time.
To sharpen up.
Yeah, but he, you know, but I had a very close relationship. So, I tried to figure out, here's someone that, you know, knows me, wants me to do well in life, but didn't expect me to do that. So there was that sense when I was young of, you know, people are going to expect things just by my gender. And certainly in the physics field, a lot of people would think that I'm not going to be good at physics. And so in some ways...
Still now?
Oh, so throughout my career, that would be the case. Now I'd less so. So the older I've got, the less that's the case.
But certainly when I was young. You put all those runs on your board and your Australian
of the year. So, but certainly, you know, when I went to Cambridge in the UK, I was the first female postdoc there, and there was 80 people in the team I was in. And, you know, it was kind of commonly said view, well, women just aren't good at physics. And it was accepted at that point. That's just
not
the way
by,
it was.
Not by you, I suspect.
No, not by me. But I look back on it, it was never a barrier to me that was there. In fact, I guess I've realised I'm quite competitive. So for me, it galvanised me to show them, yeah? And throughout my life, I've always tried to show that, you know, and find out myself, what are my boundaries? Am I good at this or am I not good at this? Yeah? Is there a barrier to me learning this? And I've learnt for myself, there is no barrier. There's never been any barriers. And actually, the biggest barriers have been my own. Mm. And so I look at my career and I think, you know, if I had been at an age, listen to them and define myself by them, my life would have been very different. But even as I've got older, I've started to push my own, you know, expectations of myself. And that's really where I've learned the most.
Mm. When Justin Trudeau was elected Prime Minister of Canada, he had more women in his cabinet than men. And one journalist kind of despairingly asked why that was the case. And he said, because it's 2018... Have we got to a turning point yet? And are there lessons for Australian politicians, policymakers, business leaders as well, about having not just the gender question, but greater diversity of voices and diversity of experience?
Yeah, look, I think diversity is critical in every way. So, you know, just from, you know, a research team, what I know, the more people from different countries, different backgrounds, the more gender balance I have, the better things work. And so I've had direct experience of that. I know it to be true. And even age, you know, it's like I say, talking to young people, we shouldn't discard what they say. The questions they ask are great questions, yeah. So diversity is absolutely critical. And I think, you know, there's a lot of political discussion about bringing more females through all these different areas. And I applaud that. And I think it is happening with time. But I think you've got to be cautious not to change it so much that young people feel that they've got to do it. Mm. You know, and so ultimately, I really believe success comes from doing something you're passionate about. And it doesn't matter what it is. That's the thing. It doesn't matter what it is. You shouldn't see what other people think defines success. You should create your own version of success for you.
Because it hinges off you being happy and fulfilled in what you're doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if you, you know, really, if you want to achieve something, you've got to give it everything. You know, you've got to be able to jump in wholeheartedly. Mm. And if you're ever trying to do something for what other people think or for other reasons or what people might think of you, that's a disaster, really.
Mm. A moment ago, we were chatting before we came out, and you said that one of the things that you don't like being introduced, particularly to young girls, is as the female scientist.
Yeah,
there are stigmas attached still, aren't there?
I think, yeah. So one of the things I've realised over the year, and I learnt it pretty quick on, is that young people don't see this as a problem for them. So they see the opportunities expanding all the time. And they look and see, you know, people talking about STEM research. They've actually said, this is a problem of your generation. You know, in our generation, we're quite happy with the way things are going. You know, they don't see it as a problem. They haven't been old enough to see it as a problem yet. So the challenge is to remove the barriers that we know exist, to open their eyes to what's possible, and then just, you know, encourage them to do what they love.
And I wonder if that extends across the board to other groups within society that might have been told in the past that you're just not going to be good at that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the concept of being good at something is really an individual thing. You know? So the person that matters most about whether you're good at something or not is you. Mm. And, you know, if you don't like something, don't do it. If you like it, keep doing it.
Yeah.
And just see what happens, yeah.
Hey, tell me, have there been lessons, not just about who Australians are, but perhaps about who you are, in that you've learned over the course of this year by being Australian of the Year?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. I guess I have learnt, I do have a very strong responsibility gene. So I do feel throughout the year that I've got a company and I've got a lot of people in there that rely on my time and energy. And so I've been trying my best to keep them you know, happy and motivated, which is not hard, actually, because there are very happy people. But I guess throughout the year I felt, you know, and I think a lot of women feel this, that I don't want to let people down. And so there's been lots of things that I wish I could have done and I just not had the time to do. Mm. And so I've learned about myself that sometimes you have to let that go. You can only do your best and try hard wherever you can and realise that, you know, you've got to put your fundamental family, number one, you know, close family, your research and your team of people that rely on you, number two, and then everything you can for everyone else.
Yeah, kind of divvy it up in that. Well, on that point about the family, how have your family coped with this and how they felt about mum being the Australian of the year?
I think they found it kind of weird. So at the beginning, I think they were totally shocked, more so than I was, and they didn't really know what it meant. I think at that age, you've got no idea.
How old are your children?
So they're 15, 14 and 11.
Yeah.
And so they've seen less of me. So it's been actually hardest on them throughout the year because I've been travelling a lot, going to different things. But I've brought them into many different forums that they would never have seen. Yeah. So they got to come to Parliament House that day and they've come on various trips with me. So they've had a unique insight too in seeing the way Australia is.
Yeah, I can imagine. And they'll probably be happy to have Mum back at the
I think they will. Big family holiday. Have a Christmas.
You'll be well deserving of that, that's for sure. What's the mantle that you pass on to whoever is the next Australian of the Year?
Yeah, look, I think it's, you know, there's a lot of things that you can do as Australian of the Year. I think one of the things that surprised me at the beginning is people said to me, you know, what's your platform? What do you stand for? And, you know, and you don't...
You've got to have one, don't you? It seems like there's the line in the sand. You've got to stand for something.
So I don't know who nominated me. I didn't know much about the scheme, I'll be honest with you. So when they asked me what platform, I was very nervous because I don't have a platform. I didn't have a platform. But then I started thinking...
I would have thought that your platform is that of exploration in the sciences.
Yeah, to be honest, I think a lot of it is making sure young girls don't miss out on the opportunity coming forward. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of high-tech changes coming. A lot of it requires maths and coding, statistics, mm-hmm. the kind of traditional things they don't like. And so what I hope I've got out to them is, you know, don't bypass those things because there's a whole world opening up and your opportunities will be reduced if you don't jump in. Hopefully I've got that message across and hopefully I've shown them that it is absolutely amazing and it's fun. You know, I have a great job, I have a great life, and, you know, and I have a family, so I don't have to give it all up. I think throughout the year, the other thing I've really learned is this concept about creating companies and breaking down boundaries. So I see Australia's in a very unique position to break down the boundaries between universities, academia, industry and government. And at the moment, those are kind of three sectors that tend to be quite isolated from each other. And schools. Mm. Schools is isolated again. Whereas Australia, because of the size and because of the fact that you can meet people in those different sectors, you can actually break those boundaries down much easier than other countries. Mm. So when I've travelled to the US, they really struggle with that. They're very, very separate in the US, whereas Australia has an opportunity to lead in that cultural sense about getting those people talking and working together. And I think that's very exciting going forwards.
Yeah, and it strikes me that you're in a unique position to be able to have a sense of what the technological world is that we're looking at in the next 5 or 10 years. Yeah. In fact, your own story is one of change. When you did your PhD, the jobs in molecular science that you're doing now... Yeah. Simply weren't around, were they? Do you have a sense of where we're going?
Ah, so that, you know, really, technologically, I can see lots of new industries coming. Mm. I see Australia, like I said, strong research base, absolutely in the best position to take advantage of that. And so for me, it's like, get rid of that self-doubt, jump across there and grab it. Other countries look at us and are nervous about how powerful we've become in certain areas.
Really?
Yeah, and we don't realise that. You know, we don't realise it. So I'm really keen to push us over that little bit of self-doubt and see what happens.
Which areas in particular? Is that around the sciences?
So, yeah, around the sciences. In the quantum science across Australia, quantum engineering is very, very strong. In places like robotics, medical devices, agriculture, you know, it's things that Australia does that takes for granted. You overseas, you know, even the banking sector, the fact you can tap on and tap off, we take it for granted. Other countries still use checks, yeah? So there's things that we do, innovative. Companies like Atlassian coming out, creating big software platforms, that over and over again, there's fantastic Australian stories. Overseas, they watch, they go, oh, there's another one out of Australia. Actually, they say, in the US, they say, if we hire an Australian, we're very happy. You know, so they know that Australians are good people to have in their companies.
Yeah, it strikes me that we don't know that here at home ourselves.
We don't, and I wish we did because it would change that kind of self-belief.
And wonder how much of it is self-belief or that thing of not putting yourself forward and not wanting to be seen as a tall poppy.
Yeah, there's an element of risk-taking as well. Mm. So we don't like to fail. you know, and I guess in the areas of startups, you generally, you know, people accept internationally, you've got to have 10 startups before you get one that's successful, whereas here, every one cannot fail. You know, and it's that mentality about you just got to keep going over and over again. If it fails, it's good. You learn something, you move on. And it's, you know, that's that risk aversion, which in the, like I said, the research side is not there, but in that kind of corporate side is there for startups anyway.
Yeah, well, and you kind of have to fail, don't you, in order to learn something to make.
It's a badge of success if you fail. So, but,
as long as that's not the only thing on the run board, is that the failures. And look, before we move on to questions, which I think we're going to have a heap, so I'm keen to get there very soon. Is there a way that, in a sense, that you look back on the last year and the way that you reflect on perhaps where this will set, what path this will set you on personally?
Look, I do feel, you know, I guess I've had that benefit of travelling internationally and realising that there's huge linkage that Australia has overseas where, again, they've recognised the benefit of having an Australian, you know, company or liaison or collaboration. And so I think going forwards, Australia's always been incredibly good at collaboration in a way that the rest of the world is not. So I'm going to try and figure out, from that collaboration, how do we bring it back and then look at what positives we can bring to Australia internally by changing that psyche and looking at, you know, future industries for Australia so that we become, you know, a leader across many fields. That's really why I hope in the future I can scope things. And in that process, you know, get that gender balance up along the way.
Yeah, well, there's certainly some big challenges and lots of opportunities there. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Michelle Simmons, thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay.
And we might open up to questions now. If you've got one, just throw your hand up in the air and we'll get a microphone to you. We'll start. This gentleman in the middle was the first. And if you can just stand up and just say your name at the start and then your question to Professor. Just in the middle here, the gentleman in the blue, just standing up there.
Good afternoon. My name's John Schmidt. Just moving on from a couple of your earlier answers, without too much of a time horizon, I'd like you to paint a bit of a scenario. If we follow sort of the pattern of the classical computer, where now it's personal all over, we get quantum into from science into technology, into engineering, into personal devices. What does the world look like? A scenario, perhaps.
Gosh, that's a very good question. It's kind of a question that's difficult for me to answer here, but I know, looking back at the history of classical computing, it's, you know, 1947 is the first transistor, 1981 before people actually had a PC that they could stick on their desk, yeah? So it's a long period of time where you have to get across all the technical challenges and engineering challenges of building hardware, you know, robust enough that the average person can use it. And I guess one of the challenges for the quantum field is looking at, in that 30-year period, what are the things that are going to come out? What are the things that are going to allow it to keep going? And so people are looking at, you know, things called quantum sensors, looking at, you know, the movement of molecules across a cell, looking at gravitational wave detection, looking at lasers and how they interact with the body, because that length scale is the kind of length scale where quantum dominates. So there's all those areas that are growing along the way to actually build this powerful computer. And so that in itself is going to be fascinating. We're seeing the world in a way and controlling it that we just couldn't do. And that will hit, you know, medicine, you know, all over. And so, but then I guess, you know, having a quantum computer, what's it going to do? I have this funny story about, probably about 10 years ago, an author came to see me and said, Michelle, I'm writing a book and I want to get the heads up from you. I'm writing a book that Australia builds the world's first quantum computer and nobody knows about it. And I want to be sure, could that happen? And I said, I don't think it could happen because once you get it, you'd start to be able to learn things and do things like, you know, playing the stock market or, you know, understanding and creating new technologies that would give you a heads up, yeah? And things would change, I think, pretty rapidly. You wouldn't be able to keep it quiet. Anyway, we had a fascinating hour-long discussion with this guy, and he didn't end up writing the book. But it's very difficult to know. It's like saying, going back to when computers were first made and people used them as hearing aids and not many people had access to them, you know, and then now look at the world. It's trying to project far ahead. I think, for me, the biggest thing is hopefully we'll get to the point where we understand how the human brain works. That would be the thing that I'm most excited about. So understanding how the body forms, how the brain works. That's an area that I think you'll see.
And I wonder if with that comes medical advances or the opportunity for them to understand illness, sickness, the way
absolutely.
To deal with cancers.
Drug design. So all of these things at the moment, we can't, you know, like I said, we can only model about 20 atoms. Molecules that are used for drugs are much, much bigger and more complex. And how they interact with the body, we have no idea. And so all of those things will start to change quite dramatically. In fact, you can see lots of genetic engineering companies, banks, all the people that want more compute powers are talking to us because they realise the limits of the technology that they currently have. Mm. And it's across every industry. That's what's amazing.
Yes, sir.
So I'm Jeff Garrett. The political overlay influencing your life as a scientist and many scientists, we're in a period, obviously, of instability. We've had 47 ministers of science in 20 minutes. It would be nice to have some coherence. If you got a letter tomorrow saying that your supreme commander for science and hopefully innovation, gluing them together, with supreme commander powers like Genghis Khan, Attila the Hun, Margaret Thatcher, that sort of stuff.
Oh, wow. It's quite the blend there.
I can imagine, yeah.
What are the two or three things that you would do or you would do differently to help our country over the next 10 to 20 years in the science?
Where's that supercomputer when you do this?
Yeah, it's like, I think one of the things I do sometimes get frustrated about is the fact that lots of people are doing great things, but it's not coordinated, and replicating different things across Australia. You mean particular technologies, or do you mean how to make Australia more of a winner?
I guess it's about making us a winner and getting more people, the coordination.
Ah, it's the coordination. Yeah, well, so we're good at collaboration as researchers. One thing I didn't realise was just how strong the different states are against each other, so I would coordinate research across the states. I see, universities all trying to get the same equipment across the country instead of pooling together and focusing. So, I would love to be in a situation where we could get a highly internationally collaborative research area where there's strength in Australia, and then make it so that the country works as a national country on that area with all the people working in the same place, with all the equipment co-located, and then internationally leading that across the world. Because I do think we would be able to lead in the collaborative research area in certain fields. And so getting collaboration, stop wasting dollars on everybody replicating the same thing would be something. But then I talked about that, breaking down the barriers between industry, government and university. We are really easily positioned to do that because people see each other. It's easier to go and talk to people from those different groups. And the cultural silos that are built up there are inherently not good, and I believe are not big enough that you can break them down. So I would be looking at schemes where you'd get those people working together for the benefit of the country and then coordinating nationally.
Mm-hmm. We're going to go up there and then we'll come down to the front and then over to the left.
Hello, Professor. My name is John. Could you please tell us a little bit more about what a qubit is and how information is encoded in an electron spin?
Sure. Okay, so a qubit literally is a quantum bit. And so in the classical world, it's a transistor. And the way a transistor works is you have a whole load of electrons that normally lie on a two-dimensional plane. You have a gate above, and you apply a voltage, and you either get the electrons to break apart, and so they don't conduct, or you encourage them to meet together, and they conduct. And that switches between on and off states. So it's literally just a charge. Either the charge can flow or the charge can't flow. In the quantum world, we're not using charge anymore. We're using an electron which holds charge, but we're using the spin. And in particular, when you look at an electron spin, it is like a little bar magnet. It has what we call angular momentum. You put it in a magnetic field, and just like a bar magnet, either aligns with the field or it aligns against the field. And those are two different energy states. It prefers to align with the field because it's the same energy, and against the field, you've got to give it energy. So you create two different energy states. In the quantum world, what we do with that little bar magnet is we get it to point anywhere on the surface of a sphere. So it's not just north and south pole of the sphere, it's anywhere on the surface. And when we do that, we're actually creating a state that you can write down as a vector, and that vector contains more information than just a one or a zero. And so it's that ability to put it on the surface of the sphere that contains more information. And then each qubit you add together, you double the amount of information. And so what we're doing is getting an electron in a magnetic field, and we're actually getting it to point onto the surface of a sphere. So you imagine that. I don't know if you imagine. So it's incredible, really. It's easy to get it up and down, but to get it to point somewhere exactly where you want on the surface, that's the quantum state we're trying to do. So that's why I talk about being three-dimensional.
And just down the front here.
My name is Dia, and I'd like to know what was your favourite or best discovery or opportunity?
Ah, oh, that's great. So, I have to admit the single-atom transistor was probably my first favourite. But I've had many. And I think one of the things about being a scientist is you've got to keep having them, yeah? And so very recently, we've got a result that's going to come out soon, I hope, where we've taken two atoms with two electron spins. And imagine if you bring them together, again, if they're like bar magnets, if they're pointing in the same way, they repel each other and they won't go together. So we've got them pointing in opposite directions. We bring them together. And what happens in the quantum world is when they get close enough, they start to feel each other and they naturally start to do this. That's quantum mechanics. We don't do anything to it, it just naturally does that. And then after a period of time, we separate them again and we measure this one. And if you measure this one, you automatically know what this one is. And so eventually we're trying to write information into two spins, bring them together, create, this is called entanglement, and then use that entanglement to get access to those states that live in between one and zero. So that's called a two-qubit gate. It's just literally happened in the last year in our labs. It's very exciting. We found that we can do this in less than one nanosecond. So it's a, you know, a super fast time, and it's 200 times faster than anybody else has done across the world. So that's the kind of thing we get very excited about. So, you know, every week something comes out, but that's my most exciting recent one.
Lots of excitement here. You might have a future engineer or scientist on your hands.
Yes. My name is Tim Guzirov. Good afternoon. Hi. I have a list of questions, if I can. If I may.
Shopping list.
Speaking about mind, what are your thoughts about Roger Penrose's ideas?
I don't have any. There you go. It's a very simple answer to your question.
Last two books, Emperor's New Mind and another one, largest one. So he thought that our brain is quantum computer technically.
Yeah. I've heard discussions about it. I haven't read the book. Mm-hmm. But I guess, you know, fundamentally I do believe that, you know, we're all made of atoms and atoms are all connected because essentially an atom is a wave function that extends in space. So in some ways, what's fascinating for me is the way that I look at the world is we try and create this entanglement. Mm-hmm. And our view as an experimentalist is when it's like this, it doesn't exist. When we bring it close together, it does exist. Mm-hmm. A theoretician, which is really where he's coming from, imagines that the world is fully entangled at all times and that you can't break the entanglement. Mm-hmm. So again, it's a very different way of looking at the world. And the reality is the entanglement's so small that as an experimentalist, I can't measure it at some distances, but I can control it to create it and measure it under certain circumstances and watch it go again. And so at the moment, it's a very much a theory versus experimental view of the world. Mm. I'm a very practical person. I know what I can measure, but I'm aware that this, you know, these wave functions go infinitely into space. So who knows about what's out there that we just haven't got the ability to see right now.
Another question about Everett. Do you agree with Everett or Everett multiverse description of quantum physics?
So, what's the question?
Do you agree with Everett or not?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm very practical. I love the concept of the fact there are many universes living at the same time. I think it allows you to see the world differently. But until we can probe it and understand it, who knows?
And from practical question, what are your thoughts about IBMQ and Microsoft Quantum? No, they don't have quantum computer yet, but quantum API from software engineering point of view.
So that's a very... There's two questions there, and you have to be a bit more explicit about what the question is.
IBMQ, because they have IBMQ computer in Melbourne, I think.
At the moment, at least five or six different types of computers. They're all in different physical systems. So the Australian team has decided to build one in silicon. It's called Silicon Quantum Computing, the company. But other groups have built them in different materials. So in the US in particular, they've got IBM, they've got Google, they've got a company called D-Wave, Quantum Circuits. There's about five or six different companies, Rigetti, that look at superconducting systems. And they're very different physical systems than the way they encode information is very different. And so at the moment, you know, the classical computing industry was all silicon, you know, some kind of germanium, but pretty much everyone's computers contain silicon chip now. For quantum computing, there are five or six different physical materials that people are using, and no one knows which one is going to work. Every one of them comes with positive and negatives, yeah? For us at the moment, our bet is that the silicon system has the longest and the highest quality qubits, and it's in a manufacturable environment, which is why we're so excited by it. But each one, you'll see over the next 5 to 10 years, results coming out from all those different systems. And it's fascinating. And all the heads of those groups, we all talk to each other. We've all got the same technical kind of challenges. We've got specific ones to our hardware, but then there's kind of software and engineering ones, which are generic across all of us. So it's, you know, culturally, mentally, in every way, it's fascinating to see how that field evolves.
We're going to go up to the back now, and then we'll come over to the right side, and then there are a couple of questions around here in the middle.
My name is Samuel, and what's your top three goals?
My top three goals in life?
And how do you relax from work?
I'm interested in that one.
So I'll go for our company because that's what I'm very focused on. So we've got, in the next 4 years, we want to build a 10-qubit system, which is called a quantum integrated circuit. So the integrated circuit was made in the 1950s for the silicon chip that we've got now, and that won a Nobel Prize, and it was really getting, you know, lots of transistors to talk to each other. So it wasn't just one on and off, but lots of them together. We're trying to do that in the quantum world, and that's called a quantum integrated circuit. So 2022, hopefully we'll get a 10-qubit system. Then beyond that, we want to build a full-scale quantum computer that can solve problems that are commercially relevant. And we're working on that at the same time. So those are two of my goals. And my third goal is to see my children have children. And I want to see that they're happy in life. So they're very much very keen to see my children grow up.
And the second part on how do you relax?
How do you... Was that the question?
I think that was it, wasn't it? Yeah.
Oh, how do I relax? It was... so at the to be honest, for a long time I played basketball. So I love playing basketball.
Oh, my granddad always
does. Great game. you don't do it then, huh?
Yeah.
You do? It's a great game. Because it's... You don't? keeping fit is how I relax. Because at the moment, your mind can only work as long as the body's still functioning well. And so the older you get, you realise you can't ignore the body. You've got to keep it healthy.
So a good diet, lots of sleep and...
lots of sleep is essential.
Perhaps doing what mum says
Doing what mum says is always a good idea.
It's just on this side, yeah.
Caitlin Matthews, I'd like to ask, you talked about how we're very competitive in the world of science, as if, you know, just as we are in sport. How do we, two-part question, how do we tell those stories and how do we use those stories to inspire people to stay in the STEM-related fields?
Yes, and one of the things I've been amazed at, and so when I first came over here, after a few years, I got involved with something called the Australia Science Media Centre, and I was working on the board of that, and I remember sitting next to, I think it was a Channel 9 editor, talking about, you know, why are there not more science stories out in the media? And he said, well, you know, people just aren't interested. And I said, really, aren't they interested? Because when I give talks, there's, you know, people are always asking questions, there's lots of people around. And he said, no, they just don't sell. So there is a cultural thing here about not celebrating scientists for whatever reason. And what you find is, if it does come up, it's always a cure for cancer. You know, so that's, and there's nothing else that exists in some ways, yeah? So the amazing thing for me is, when I first arrived, I got to be a women in physics lecturer, and I went all across the country, and I went to each department, and I met these fantastic research leaders in many areas, in physics and medical science. And I remember thinking, wow, there's all these great stories in Australia that we don't tell. So I would love to change the rhetoric that we have, like, you know, a standard piece in the newspaper or on the news that talks about the latest and greatest, and there's so many stories to tell. You know, Australia's strong in so many different areas. So that, I don't know how we change that. I'd love to know. One of the things I've been talking about is, we have a lot of young people go out and compete in the International Science Olympiads. And again, they go off, they come back, they do fantastic, and sometimes they win. Does anyone know about it? No, but that should be, like, you know, constantly celebrated. So celebrating when our young people do well would be the target, I would say. And then, as you know, as people get great results across the country, having a constant science forum in the media would be great. But I don't know how we achieve that.
And on that point, I think the media is one of the big challenges here, and having worked across mediums from print, TV, radio and the like, the ABC does it differently to others. But in the commercials, at least from my experience, it's very difficult to tell stories that are as complex as the sciences in a way that is as concise as what the news demands. Yeah, I'm not defending the model at the moment. That's just what it is. I think that's part of the challenge myself in telling those stories. And I wonder if that's, you know, part of the change that might be needed. We've got one just here, then down the front, second row here, and then over there.
Hi. So very powerful technology can put to good use or can be put to bad use. I just wondered what your thoughts were, sort of the ethical implications and those kinds of challenges are.
Yeah. So this is, you know, I think one of the things in science in general, and I actually feel very strongly about this, part of the reason I encourage government to become an investor in the technology is because at the moment it is going to be transformational if it all works in the way we think. And so I didn't want to be responsible for, you know, looking at all the issues that would come from that myself, because I'm not an expert in that. So getting government behind it and realising the defence implications and how it can be used for good and bad is something I was very keen about. But I think, you know, as a scientist, you know, in some ways we are ethical every day in the choice of things we do. You know, we have to publish good data, we have to understand it well. So ethics is kind of ingrained into scientists. But when it gets to the point where technology starts to evolve and it starts to be functionally useful, then I think you've got to bring in teams that understand what the implications are. And the only way I know how to do that is to bring government with you and make sure they're constantly aware of where it's going. And so that's been my own approach. And I'm conscious that, you know, there's a dual functionality here. You've got to pay attention to that. You've got to have it integrated in what you're doing. At the same time, if you have too much of it, and I guess I start to see this actually across the world, if you have too much regulation right at the beginning, it will stifle that innovation coming through. So there's a point at which, as it starts to become commercially relevant, you've got to embed it.
Just in the front here.
Hello, my name is Rajiv. So I did a PhD in quantum mechanics about 20 years ago, but thank you for explaining to my daughter far better than I ever could. But my question actually is, well, I end up going to a career in IT and cybersecurity, and I often get asked this one, so I'm interested in your answer. So is quantum computing going to be the saviour of cybersecurity, or is it going to be the death knell for security?
That's a great question. So at the moment, I think it's going to be something that challenges security as it exists, and it will integrate. So it will be useful in some way. So people worry about if it gets big enough, it's going to break codes, and what are we going to do? And so there's all kinds of field quantum hard cryptography that are growing out of that, yeah? But fundamentally, quantum will be good at certain things and not good at other things, and to get something that can break codes is going to be very big. So I guess the challenge is, at the moment, those two fields will work together. So classical and quantum will be integrated. You won't have a classical chip and a quantum chip that do different things. They will work together in some ways. And I think that understanding how to get problems to go to the classical part, how to go to the quantum part, and get them working together is going to be quite critical. So I think it's neither the saviour or the end, it's the partner.
Yeah, that's the answer I normally give. Hedge my bets.
But part of the challenge is, of course, what it's used for and what the regulations are around it, isn't it? And that's where, to the point that you made on the earlier question, that having governments and politicians involved without stifling it. I mean, that's probably the sweet spot, isn't it, of having enough regulation to protect privacy and integrity, but not so much red tape that it stifles development.
Yeah, and, you know, in that, you've got to have enough people that are skilled in understanding it. And so part of that is the educational aspect of what it really is and what it can and can't
do. So there might be new careers in quantum ethics.
Absolutely. Sometime in the future. It's artificial intelligence is getting it, machine learning, so it will be in quantum too.
And just starting.
Hi, my name is Sharon. I have a PhD in biotechnology. I just want to ask, what are your views about in the future, where we would see big data and data mining and the relationship between that and quantum computing in the future, in the next 5 years?
So in the next 5 years, I mean, that's a field that's growing rapidly right now, but it's really right at the beginning. So I think you'll start to see more and more coming out in that space. So part of the challenge at the moment, so quantum has this ability to use these states in between, but ultimately you've got to get information into and out of the computer as well, which is why classical and quantum have got to go together. So the, you know, how big can it compute? How much information can you get in and out fast enough is going to be a challenge for the field. And so at the moment, it's still very practical engineering problems, but eventually those two fields will start to come together, and you'll start to see some problems going off to the quantum chip and some going to the classical chip. So the next 5 years, it will be, you know, small scale stuff, but a huge number of people are going into that.
Was that your question?
And we are at 1 o'clock now, but if you're happy, you think we've got one more question just over here.
Hi, Michelle. My name's Tim Dyke, and thank you again for coming to talk to us. It's been really interesting. I wanted to know, if at some point in the future an archaeologist came along and found your lab as it is now, what would they find? And I guess I had a second question for my daughter who didn't want to ask it, which is, how hard is it to convince people of the value of your research?
Okay, so what they would find. So we, honestly, the technology that we use to manipulate atoms, uses ultra-high vacuum, so it's actually the same kind of forces that exist in rockets out in space. And so if you look at the machines we use, they are actually things that could go up into space. So it's the same kind of technology. So it's like a mini kind of rocket-looking machine. And so within that is big, shiny bits of stainless steel, huge pumps to actually fabricate them. But we actually have three types of technology, three labs. One is the putting the atoms in place with these microscopes that are big and stainless steel-like. The next one is a full-on Intel clean room. So, you know, where you see all the white suits and people going in and taking their chip through 50 different processes to turn it from a wafer into a chip with lots and lots of connections and your transistors defined in it, yeah? And so that is a huge area with lots of different tools, each tool, you know, $1 million each, and they will, you know, do either chemistry or etching or deposition of different materials. And so that, you know, that would look quite odd, I think, I don't know however long it is, and they're looking at it. Lots of tools that are embedded in the ground made of metal and glass. And then finally, when we measure them, we measure them on something called a dilution fridge. So our third lab is literally, we call it a cryostat. It's a huge piece of stainless steel. It's got lots of very fine metal connections that go through, or we pump liquids through very small tubes. So it's very, very high tech, lots and lots of metal, lots of cables that come down. And then electronics racks, huge numbers of electronics racks passing these signals through. So they would come and they would find a lot of hardware. A lot of stuff, and it depends on how they arrive at it. But if they didn't know the technology, I can only imagine it would be fascinating. Or if they've gone well beyond that technology, they'd be thinking, "God, look at what these guys used to do." So I can imagine that, yeah, it would be fascinating. But at the moment, it's right at the forefront, all of those areas. So it'd be, yeah.
Perhaps they'll also be thinking, wow, thank heavens that they were doing that,
because that's where it
where it got us to. And the second part of that question
was about how important it is. Not hard at all, to be honest. I've not found it hard because fundamentally we are pushing the boundaries, and you can track with time. Every time a new way of looking at the world has come along, like, you know, the ability to see the human body and open it up, how that changed medicine. Every time new technologies come, the ability to see the stars and know that the planets go around the sun and not us. Every time we found something, you've opened up the whole different way of looking at the world. The first transistor led to the computing age. And so this is a new technology. It's very clear that we have some understanding about it, but it's this big. And imagine what it would be if it was this big. So I think it's not hard at all. You just have to believe in the fact that humans are great at ingenuity, and good things come from investing and doing new things.
Now, I know we are right out of time, but there was just one, maybe a little question here. We'll just get you the microphone there.
Hi, my name's Emma and I'm 7 years old. I was wondering, what's the most surprising discovery that you've made in quantum physics? And who do you play basketball against?
So the most surprising discovery, I'm going to try and explain this and I'm going to watch your face to see if you get it, is if you imagine taking a wire, and if you pass electrons in, you expect the electrons to come out the other side, yeah? So if you make that wire thinner and thinner and thinner, eventually as the electrons come through, they get trapped. They can't get there because the edges of the wire stop it coming through to the other end, yeah? And so that's, everyone knows, it's called Ohm's law. The thinner you make the wire, the harder it is to get the electrons through, yeah? And so we made a wire that was one or two atoms thick. And at the time we made it, we didn't expect it to work because we thought the electrons are never going to make it through. And it worked. And actually it worked in a way that was as if it was 10 atoms thick. So the resistance didn't drop. And at the time when we found that, it didn't make any sense. It defied everything that was out there. We've now understood why it is, and there's lots of complicated reasons for that. But we can now make these wires very, very thin. And companies like Intel have picked up on the technology that we use to make that wire, because all their transistors have lots of wires going to it. And when you, I don't know if you found a computer, if you pick it up, it's hot. So it generates a lot of heat, and they have fans in there to cool it down. It's because those wires are so thin, they get resistive and they heat up. Anyway, so a very thin atom wire was probably the surprise that we didn't expect it to work. And basketball. So actually, I used to play basketball in a men's team with a bunch of American postdocs that came over, and it was great. It was just a pick-up match. I go every day, and it was fantastic. I'd look forward to that game every day.
Oh, outstanding. Look, thank you so much for joining us here today. It's been great to talk to you, and also great across this year to learn more about your field of sciences and perhaps opening the doorway to greater discussions and understanding of what it is and how it fits into our society. But thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, Dan. Professor Michelle Simmons.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.